Back together again, you and I chatting it up, brand new week, Monday style, December 15th, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today, where we welcome the 16th District GOP State Senate member Rob Sampson to the show. We talked about proposed safety and security measures for future expanded use of no-excuse absentee balloting in Connecticut elections. Retired FBI agent and University of New Haven senior criminal justice lecturer Ken Gray dropped by again to talk about this past weekend's mass shootings at Brown University and on the beach in Australia and the developing case of the murder of actor-producer Rob Reiner and his wife.
So apparently, because of a referendum question that was voted on with 56% yes, I think this was back in 2024, last year, the state will eventually, now it may take some time, the state will eventually migrate to no-excuse absentee balloting, meaning that one of the six conditions that we currently have for using an absentee ballot won't matter anymore. Now, currently, if I remember most of them, it is an infirmity, you're sick, you're going to be out of the country, there's a religious issue, you just won't be in town on election day, you'll be working at another polling place. There's, I believe, six of them. Those are all going away. So in a sense, what you're going to have is mail-in voting. Now, they're not calling it mail-in voting, but that's essentially what it is, because essentially every voter in Connecticut could, if they want to, without an excuse, order an absentee ballot. Now, what kind of protections are we going to have on that? And we heard from State Rep Matt Blumenthal the other day that there may already be a framework for this. Well, a gentleman joining us right now may have something to say about that, our buddy Republican State Senate member Rob Sampson, and he is the ranking member on the Government Administration and Elections Committee. He represents the 16th District, Cheshire, Prospect, Southington, Wolcott, and the city of Waterbury, trying to get all its water back. Rob, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
I am well, Paul. Glad to speak with you, and I'm actually calling you from a city under siege. I'm in Waterbury at the moment,
yeah.
And actually been dealing with a lot of constituents facing some really difficult times. No water. Mm-hmm. I talked to some folks that now they don't have any heat either because their boilers are affected by the lack of water. I mean, it's really becoming quite the catastrophe.
What have you, Rob, or anybody in the legislature, anybody in general? I know they're trying to do this, obviously, as fast as they can. Have you heard any estimates in the last few hours or not? What are you hearing? Anything?
I'm only privy to the same thing that the rest of the public is. I'm keeping an eye on the mayor's press releases that have been coming fast and furious several a day. And I'm just hopeful that they've got the right people on the job to get it done.
All right, Rob, let's talk about voting here. And I know Matt Blumenthal was quoted the other day, a couple of days ago, and you had a quote back to that, like saying you haven't seen anything. But apparently, Rob, are we to understand here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is there already a framework in here for what will, I guess, be mail-in voting if everybody requests a no-excuse absentee? Any sorts of protections here, or is this going to be done hush-hush? What do you know here on this?
Paul, at the risk of complicating the question, let me just say that the Democrats created absentee voting for all in Connecticut during the pandemic, and they've never looked back.
Okay.
They, in fact, changed the statute shortly thereafter that they had acted on without it passing into law yet, that basically redefined the notion of illness, which is one of the reasons, to mean illness. Not that you're sick or I'm sick, but, you know, just illness exists in the world.
Yeah.
You could potentially get sick. You know someone's sick.
You're afraid of getting sick. I right, Rob? Didn't they say during all this, well, just the fear of getting sick is good enough, right?
That is correct, yes. And as a result, we already have it, although I don't think it's common knowledge among the public. And, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, we could debate the merits of something like this as a policy, but the issue I have with the Democrats is not necessarily this particular policy, but the fact that they want to put these things forward without the other side of the equation. They are expanding access to voting all the time, which I think is a great and noble thing, and I'm all for it, except they never do the security piece with it. Other states that have expansive mail-in voting or early voting. They put protections and protocols and security in place. These Democrats, they don't do any of that in Connecticut. We have the most wide-open, unbelievably, you know, insecure election system in the country, in my view, and they want to do nothing to address it. I offer amendment after amendment every year, you know, a photo ID, signature verification. These are things that are common knowledge in other states, and yet they will have no part of it. And you know as well as I know that what happened in Bridgeport is just the tip of the iceberg. Once this absentee voting becomes commonplace, that means that the ground warriors that are willing to go beyond the framework of what's legal are going to be able to use it to their advantage. And it's a scary thought.
Yeah. So, Rob, I think we understand, a lot of us do, because the debate about photo ID, that's been around for years. But you mentioned two key words here that I try to impress on people all the time. Signature verification. Explain technically what that is. You and I know what it is, and I think a lot of people do. Signature verification, envelopes, what goes into what? What do you want to see out of that? What would make you happy? Because as you say, I've read about this, and yeah, all these other states have signature verification, but it's done in a very secure way.
Right. Well, a signature verification can actually mean a lot of things, but what it basically boils down to is a way to firmly identify the voter when accepting their ballot. Other states that use a lot of mail-in voting, what they do is they essentially have a protocol set up when you register to vote to capture your signature and make sure that it's understood by the state and the person registering that that's your signature that will be matched whenever you vote. Some other states use other things. They use QR codes. They use other types of identification for a way to be able to match the person to the vote later on. In Connecticut, they don't bother. You could put an X on your absentee ballot, and they will still count it as if it was you. It's absurd, and it's really a shame.
Rob, can you have your dog, like, get ink on the paw, or your cat? Will they take a paw print? Well, does that work? Can you tell me? Because I might be into that. You know.
It has in the past. I mean, look, I don't want to cast aspersions on the current Secretary of State, but during the pandemic, the Secretary of State of the in Connecticut, Denise Merrill, she advised the registrars and people running local elections to accept all of them, regardless. Signature missing, signature in X, doesn't really look like it. Just take them all.
Rob, you know, it's interesting because I read that story and I know you've been in the middle of this. God bless you. But I have to laugh, Rob, and I do that in kind of a tongue-in-cheek way. I call it the dreaded D word. And you know what that word is? Anytime there's enhanced security, Rob Sampson talked about this, we get, well, we don't want to disenfranchise people. I mean, come on. It's the year 2025. Rob, this idea that any extra thing that the state asks a voter to do that they have to do five times of if they go to their local bank or buy a car, we don't, I mean, the disenfranchise, they're already starting with that, Rob. I mean, give me a break.
Of course. Well, I got another D word, and that's disingenuous, which is what that claim is.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I do every election cycle, Paul, is I put a bill in every time to require cities where they typically have the problem of having long lines at the polls. And for me, that's the number one thing discouraging people from voting.
Yeah.
To require these towns to have enough polling locations.
Open another
to allow people to vote. And you know what? The Democrats, another D word, they voted down.
They
another
say no.
D word, because they really don't care about any of that. What they want to do is create the ability for as many votes to be cast, whether they're legitimate or not. Mm. And frankly, that's how you disenfranchise people, is by having phony votes alongside genuine votes.
Now, and Rob, finally, we're going into the ostensibly short session, the even years, the election years. So is there going to be enough time, Rob, in this session to do anything substantive on this? Or is there going to be another? Because I would assume the majority party wants this in for 2026, or is that just not practical?
Well, it's certainly practical if they have the nerve and the will to put it forward. Mm-hmm. In the last legislative cycle, we didn't pass hardly any election-related policy because the chair of the state Senate Government Administration and Elections Committee didn't want to come to the floor to debate the bills. She knew that I was going to ask very hard questions. I was going to put up the amendments on voter ID and signature verification, and they didn't want to have the conversation. And I will put them on notice that if they bring another election bill to the floor, we're going to have that conversation. So it's up to them. They can decide to try and push it forward, but they got to know they got to go through me to do it.
All right. This gentleman represents parts of Cheshire, Prospect, Southington, Wolcott, and Waterbury. Republican State Senate member Rob Sampson. Rob, I'm sure we'll be talking about this in the coming weeks. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
No doubt about it. Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it. All right, one of our go-to guys and gals for stuff like this when we have shootings, major crime investigations, is our buddy, University of New Haven, senior criminal justice lecturer Ken Gray, retired FBI agent. He was on earlier today with Melissa. Want to bring him back this afternoon. He's an authority on this sort of stuff. Ken, good afternoon. Good to chat with you, although it's sad we have to bring you on stuff like this. But thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Hi, Paul. Glad to be with you again.
Ken, let's look at that. Now, we have three major stories here. I think two of them seem to be, Ken, it's somewhat cut and dry. You have, sadly, Rob Reiner's, one of his kids, the cops jumped on him pretty quickly. The alleged throat-slashing deaths of him and his wife, and I guess... Ken, in one situation, I guess one of his kids or a relative said, you know, go look at the son. And I guess that's the first thing law enforcement does is look at family members, correct?
Yes. In this particular case, Rob and his wife and their son, Nick, had been at a party the night before at Conan O'Brien's.
Yeah.
And they had a knockdown, drag-out fight there.
Wow.
Rob and his wife left that party. And then the next day, when he failed to answer the door, when he had a massage scheduled, his daughter came across and found the two of them dead in their home.
Ooh.
And she told police to look at her brother, that her brother was dangerous. He had a history of being in and out of rehab over the years. And apparently he had been having a fight with his parents and it resulted in their death.
The Australia mass shooting, Ken, just horrible. A large contingent of Australian Jews on the beach there, celebrating the first day and night of Hanukkah on Sunday into Sunday night, happened early Sunday morning our time. Ken, there's a lot of video of this. Apparently a father and the son, one of them's dead. Thank God for this other gentleman you see who hunkers down behind a car and then is able to restrain one of the gunmen here. And I guess now, Ken, the finger pointing in Australia is, again, as I always say and as you always point out, usually they find something out previously that may have raised a red flag here. And I know there's finger pointing about that now.
Absolutely. But, you know, here's the thing is that you can suspect a person of being a supporter of terrorism or possibly of thinking about doing terrorism.
Yeah.
But until they actually take some substantive step, you can't really arrest them. And so in this particular case, the father-son had come to the attention of law enforcement beforehand. But again, without them actually doing anything or preparing to do something, they could not do anything until they actually acted. In this particular case, their action led to multiple deaths and multiple injuries. And as you say, if it were not for the action of that one brave citizen to go and tackle one of the two shooters from behind, the body count could be even greater.
Ken, let's go to this Providence, Rhode Island case, Brown University. I've been to that area several times, having done road radio hockey games there. Very tight area, much the way the Yale campus is packed into a lot of New Haven. So, Ken, this is an odd case, isn't it? At least on the surface here, somebody walks into a college campus on a Saturday morning into an engineering school. They go up to where there's a review session on a weekend for an upcoming final exam, not unusual.
They shoot 11 people, killing two of them, nine others hurt, and they exit the building. They thought they had somebody, person of interest. They release that man. So now what is going on, Ken, as far as FBI, local police, state police? Walk us through what they're probably doing. Are they let me ask this, because I brought this up earlier. Are they maybe looking for somebody who may have had a beef with the school?
So that's one of the possible routes that is being explored. Is there somebody who flunked out of Brown? Is there somebody who applied to Brown and was turned down, or somebody who used to work for Brown and was fired? Those are all possible investigative lead areas to work on. The other possibility, of course, is that random person walking into campus and choosing to pick that classroom to start shooting. But this is a building, as you say, just like Yale. They have streets from the city all intersecting with the campus.
Mm-hmm.
The person could have walked in there without being associated with Brown, but I doubt that very seriously. I think there must be some connection with Brown University, and that those are investigative avenues that have to be pursued. I just got finished seeing news footage where the Bureau was searching through bushes nearby the campus there, looking for maybe the murder weapon that was maybe tossed while the person was walking away. But there's 800 cameras around the university there, and all you have is this visual of the person walking away from the camera. That's pretty hard to believe. I also saw additional footage today showing a further scene of the person walking, continuing down the street. But again, no facial identification, no information to even show the race of the person.
Possible head fake, Ken? Do they maybe have other footage? You would think the building itself had numerous cameras. Could this, Ken Gray, be a little bit of a head fake to say, all right, we're coming after you, but we don't want to let you know we know who you are, or not?
No, I don't think so. I think that if they had an identification of this person, they would be arrested already if they were located. As they picked up this person based upon a tip, the person of interest was based upon a tip, and then that person was geolocated and brought in for questioning, but he was quickly, through interrogation, determined not to be associated with it, also forensically not associated with the case. And so I think they're really, in many ways, back to square one, trying to identify a possible suspect in this case based upon forensic evidence and based upon potential information provided by some of the victims that might lead to an identification. But so far, nothing.
Yeah, and Ken, you know, finally here at Connoisseur, as probably at UNH, Ken, where you are there, look, I can't go to the bathroom here without going through two doors and using my door card to click me out of a first door, out of a second door, back into the second door, and back into the first door, and here to the studio. So you would think, Ken, and we could be wrong here, that there's got to be security, I would think, or door card registrations of how this person may have gotten into the building on Saturday. I would think that would be the first thing they would look at, right?
They did look at that, but here's the thing, is that this is the Boris and Holly building. It's a seven-story building. It's got 117 labs, 150 offices, 15 classrooms, and this is finals week. So as to facilitate people to take their finals, the entrances did not require being keyed into it. And so this person gained entry without having to go through any type of security check and exited the building on Holly Street and departed the area, according to the police thought on it right at the moment. So, you know, they, like I said, they are working with limited amount of information and trying to develop that information. And unfortunately, because of this person of interest has temporarily delayed the investigation, a lot of students have left already for the holidays. So that makes it that much more difficult.
Retired FBI lecturer Ken Gray, retired agent, currently University of New Haven senior criminal justice lecturer. Ken, as always, we appreciate your expertise. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, Ken. Wow.